sheet in the back, and Ellen said that she will take the responsibility to send anybody who signed up on that list an electronic version of the book. Okay.
The ebook is going to cost as much as the paperback.
Yeah.
I just love the economics of that. They don't have to pay for anything.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know that, right?
And they pay you off of this.
And they pay, yeah, no, I'm making nothing off of this book. I mean, really, it's like my royalties are really unbelievably small. No, there's a lot of crazy economics and all of that. And actually, yeah, and actually the publisher said, I said, well, couldn't you sell it for less? And they're like, no, that there's all this kind of crazy politics between the publishing companies and the ebook people. Anyhow, look. But anyhow, but I give you a PDF for nothing. Okay, so questions, comments, objections? Yeah. Okay, it's really interesting.
From a very radical point of view.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. So, you guys know Naomi Klein, right? So Naomi Klein has written a lot of really great radical stuff. And she had an article in The Nation about a year ago, and I don't remember the title of that article, but if you look up The Nation and Naomi Klein, you should be able to find it pretty quickly. And it's interesting, she argues in that paper that you have to get rid of capitalism to solve the climate crisis. And I think it's a really interesting, hard question, and I just want to kind of play with that for a couple of minutes. But before I go there, I also want to say, but there's all these sort of new economist people who in some ways they're radicals, but they just don't admit it. And so there's a couple of other authors that I think are really important that put this really strongly in an environmental frame. I would say Bill McKibben has a book called Deep Economy. Then Juliet Shore has a book called Plentitude. And David Corton has a book called, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on it, it's in the back of the book. I have a terrible memory for things like this. Anyhow, but look up David Corton. He's one of these people who's written a ton of stuff about this. One of his concepts is the great turning. All three of these authors that I just mentioned are talking about the fact that we need to really transform and shift the economy. Again, they don't talk about capitalism, they don't talk about exploitation, they don't really talk that much about power, but they do say that to have a sustainable economy, it needs to shift in some really powerful ways toward a less consumer-oriented economy. But see, what they talk about is, and actually even Gibson and Graham, who I rely on in this book a lot, they have this wonderful thing about all this non-capitalist stuff that's around us that's wonderful. But they don't talk about power. And so I think as a more hardcore grounded leftist myself, that it's really important to talk about those forces that are keeping us from making progress. So I'm just gonna sort of blather on for a couple of minutes about this because I'm completely embedded in climate politics and I think it's really important. And then remind me if I don't get back to Naomi Klein. Okay, I forgot what I was just about to say.
Talk about AB 32 and
Well, but let's talk about that for a second, though, because I actually think that AB 32 is just incredibly important. And even though, Governor Arnold, who we all really despise, he was the guy it passed under. And yet, I think it's really, really important. So a couple different levels. So I guess one of the things that I think is that we have, this is what the train of thought I was going to go on, is that we have to take on the bad guys, okay? And we have to stop the fossil fuel industry. So let me take that tangent, then we'll get back to AB 32. So I'm working, at my college at a campaign with 350. They're 350.org. Is a really great organization. Bill McKibben is their superstar, even though it was started by his students, not by him. Anyhow, yeah.
You might slow down just a little and repeat that.
Okay, except I'm so excited about her question subject. Okay, 350.org. So they they're part of a campaign called Fossil Free. What they're wanting to do is to take away the license of the fossil fuel industry. And the strategy, it's great, because I've been involved in climate change stuff for, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years, and it's felt really frustrating because there's the, okay, I can do all my individualistic stuff. Everybody knows about that. I drive an electric car, though I didn't drive it here because it doesn't go that far. All the good things you can do as an individual. And you can sort of get your municipality to do some better things. AB 32 is super important. It was passed with the support of business because the skiing industry and the agricultural industry are rational capitalists, and they did not oppose it because they actually know that they're going to be really in serious trouble with climate change. So there are plenty of cap. What I would say is that the rational capitalists are on our side with respect to the climate, and that that's a good thing, because I hope the rational capitalists do their rational capitalist work and make it so that, you know, that they make things better. But meanwhile, there's the fossil fuel industry, which has completely captured, or has to a large extent captured, the state in the United States. The fossil fuel industry has totally captured the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Whereas it used to be kind of a mixed organization that was mostly reactionary, it's now entirely reactionary, and entirely reactionary in the favor of the fossil fuel industry. So the solar industry, you know, is not being supported by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is incredibly politically powerful. Meanwhile, ExxonMobil and some other oil companies put millions of dollars into the climate denial industry, and that's a really important thing that I think people need to know. George Monbiot is a really great radical writer on the climate, by the way. He has a book called Heat. It's what got me involved in climate politics. M-O-N-B-I-O-T. He's a British journalist, really good. And he has this great chapter where he does a total expose of the fossil fuel industry basically hired the lobbyists who worked on the tobacco industry, because the tobacco people put a huge amount of money into sowing this sense of doubt in science about the link between lung cancer and tobacco smoking, right? So there was a long time where it was like, well, that's a correlation, not a causation, and we can't be absolutely sure, and it hasn't been proven. And they sowed just enough sense of doubt to kind of slow down the anti-tobacco movement for a long time. Well, the fossil fuel industry basically hired the exact same lobbyists and did the exact same thing to create this whole campaign to sow a sense of doubt and skepticism in the public around climate. If you think back to even when Al Gore's movie came out, and what was that? I have a terrible memory. It was like around 2007 or so. When that movie came out, you know, there's a lot that was wrong with that movie. But at that point, it was like, holy crap, the planet's about to burn up. We got to do something about it. There's a real sense of urgency, and there was a sense of consensus, even in this country, that we had better do something about the climate. Then the denial industries got some force behind it, and we had 10 years of kind of dithering, really, on the climate. So I think that that game is now over. And the 350, I think it's been hard to think strategically about what things to do about the climate, because it's everywhere and nowhere, the politics. But this tactic of going after the fossil fuel industry is brilliant. And I would urge you to see, there's a, Bill McKibben just did a national tour, and he called it Do the Math. And there's a great video of it. There's a 3-minute version and there's a 45-minute version. If you look up Do the Math, and what he claims there that I think is very powerful is that the oil companies already have kind of, you know, explored and kind of in their asset portfolios 5 times more fossil fuel than is safe to burn. So if they use all of their assets, the game is over. So then you have to say, okay, so they're going to end up either destroying the planet or having a bunch of sunk assets. So they're doing a divestment movement, and it's very powerful. It's spreading like wildfire, and I'm really excited about it. And it's interesting because at my campus, we've never had a divestment movement, and now my college president is like coming after me asking for the students to please hurry up their work because it's got to happen tomorrow. My husband teaches at San Francisco State, and it was a similar thing. They thought it was going to take forever. They thought there was going to be all this resistance, and the president was just like, they haven't done it yet, but the president's very excited about it. So the point is that the city of San Francisco passed a divestment resolution. And the idea of that is that it's not that you're going to stop ExxonMobil by taking their money away, but what we're trying to do is to take away the social license of the fossil fuel industry, to treat them like pariahs, like the tobacco companies. And I think it's very powerful and really important. Okay, so that's one aspect of what I think it's really an exciting movement. It's taking off like crazy. And then the other aspect of your question about sort of what radicals are saying about the climate, a lot of it has to do with the three authors that I had mentioned earlier. Their thing is more about what we need to do to have a sustainable economy. And there's a lot of good stuff about what a sustainable economy looks like. And I think that that's important, even though those same authors don't say, okay, how are we going to get there, given the fact that the oil companies are running the country and that you know, transnational companies are running the world. Those authors don't take that on. They're more like, let's try to build some good things. I think that's a lot about that.
So just to push just a little bit more.
Okay.
So in terms of, you know, naming capitalism as the problem,
Right.
I direct environmentalists who are naming capitalism as the problem. On the other hand, are there Marxist radical economists who are naming the environment as the present?
Yeah, so there's a journal called Capitalism, Nature, Socialism that comes out of Santa Cruz, right? And they do really good stuff. Joel Cavell is somebody who's really interested in this. He's done a lot of other work and interesting stuff, but he's somebody who's writing in that area. Oh, and the last thing I was going to say is that in Naomi Klein's article, what she claims is that you really can't get past, you can't solve the climate crisis without getting past capitalism. And I actually have to say that I actually don't agree with that. I think that we're going to try to do the best we can to challenge capitalism in the ways we can. And I do think you can't solve the climate crisis without strong regulation. I think that's true. And that's why conservatives are so into climate denial, because it means regulation. But I think you can have capitalism with regulation. So what I would say is that a move towards what I'm arguing for in this book is also what we need to do to deal with the climate crisis, which is really intense regulation, which is what AB 32 does. AB 32, 80% of the reductions in AB 32 come from regulations, and I think it's just beautiful. You know, and it's amazing to me that it passed in this state with almost no opposition. And California is has some of the strongest climate legislation in the world, and I don't think that that's anything to scoff at just because it was a bunch of liberals and conservatives who passed that law. Yeah.
Yeah, you spoke of rational capitalism, and I'm wondering whether you would consider the solar power industry an example.
Yeah, definitely.
Capitalism, even if it were owned by
I meant that slightly ironically, but what I meant by rational capitalism was capitalists who understand their own self-interest, right? In other words, it seems to me that, you know, because there are ways that the business class, like this is what the Chamber of Commerce is about, let's get all these, you know, capitalists that usually compete with each other working together for certain things that they all need, like a stable banking system.
But a capitalist as such.
Uh-huh.
Continues seeking profit in the industry by which he makes a living.
Yeah.
Would then the irrational capitalist go out of business?
Well, so I don't want to put too much in that concept of the rational capitalist, because I don't even believe in the concept of rationality. That was my doctoral dissertation.
Well, by nature, capitalism is irrational.
Yeah, yeah. No, so like I said, I meant that ironically, and all I meant by that was to say, capitalists, you'd think that the capitalist class, if it understood its own self-interest, it wouldn't be into burning the planet down. That's all I meant.
Self-interest is to make profit, not to make a better world.
Well, no, not to make a better world, no, but there are some capitalists who think long-term and there's some capitalists who think short-term. And what I'm saying is that throughout most of the history of capitalism, the most powerful capitalists have thought somewhat long-term. The big capitalists were like, okay, let's have a banking system that's ruled by law.
Replace coal with oil, replace oil with atomic energy.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Right, and so I think it's completely possible to have a sustainable capitalism. I think it's totally possible. You know, alternative energy, and I'm not saying that's a good thing, I'm just saying I just think it's a fact. Yeah.
Yeah, two things. The lady over here, she asked about the YouTube address. Did you get that?
So he was saying in the back, it's called The Story of Stuff. Yeah.
Stuff?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all about planned obsolescence and, you know, just people just buying stuff. It's like, yeah, I forget. She has some great number, and I forget what it is, but about how long most products last, but it's about, like, you know, a few days or something like that. You know, you buy the thing, you use it once it breaks, and then it's in the garbage, and then you gotta buy another one.
All right, the second is that when you were speaking about the state being necessarily evil, it came to mind. Book I read written by Adrian Brown before he went to Princeton, and he states in it, I hate the state.
Uh-huh.
I hate the state. He does appear to be, I won't say a religious utopian, but he gave us some evidence of how the state has not really helped the companies of the workers' world. So when you say that it's a necessary right is altogether wrong when they talk about the overly concerned. I think that there's some things in there that concern them.
Yeah.
And especially when you look at the fact that the people who represent us in terms of, you know, poor working people, we don't give money to their campaigns.
Right.
So, you know, you don't want to go off in utopianism, but you do want to look at this aspect of the state. So what, have you thought about it? Have you written about it?
A lot, yeah. There's a lot in the book about the state and it's a really interesting and really complicated question, and so just to take a couple stabs at it, I think of the state as a contested site. So like I was saying about the New Deal, you know, that there are some ways that you could say that, like I said, that the working class fought really hard and got some huge concessions, and so now we have things like occupational health and safety standards, Social Security, Food and Drug Administration. I think those are environmental, and later the Environmental Protection Agency. I think that those are agencies that do really, really important things for us. And those are things done by a state, right? And it's interesting because, I've known a lot of anarchists. I've been in sort of political community with a lot of anarchists. Lots of the students who I work with are really attracted to anarchism. And so I dug into a really, you know, just like I was like, reform versus revolution. What do people mean when they say that? I really like went back and read all that old stale stuff and really thought it through. Same thing with the stuff about the state. And one of the things that, you know, I think I used to be more of an anarchist than I am now. And I think that one of the things that gets really tricky in those debates with anarchists about, you know, can we live without a state is, what do you even mean by a state? I think to have, because there's a way that, like, you know, when I dug into this, it's like there's a technical definition of the state that comes from Max Weber uses it, Engels uses it, that like the state is, it basically the state is defined as, this isn't really a definition, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it's basically like the legitimate use of force. Like the state is that entity that is legitimized to use force. Well, if that's what the state is, that's a pretty bad thing, right? But if you say, I want to live in a large-scale society, and by the way, the people are starting to say, and I believe this, that that cities are, if we're going to have a fairly large human population, which we think is now going to stabilize, there's huge debates over this, but I would say at around 9 billion is what the population of the Earth is likely to stable at. It's like starting to kind of, it's really leveling off at a much faster rate than people had imagined earlier. In any case, if you have 9, 10, 11 billion, that's the range that people talk about. It seems to me impossible for us, I think that cities are an important social form, is I guess what I'm saying. When you have a lot of people, cities are actually a very efficient way for people to live. Transportation is less, you have smaller, more condensed housing, stuff like that. So cities are good things. If you have a city, you have to have some mechanism for structuring utilities, sewage, mail service, right? All that kind of stuff. Like, you know, I'm not sure what you call the entity that makes that happen except a state. And so if you say you're for or against a state, part of what you have to get into is what is a state. So if a state is some kind of big social mechanism that takes care of those kinds of things in slightly bureaucratic ways, I don't really have a problem with that. So it sort of, and so I think that you're right that there's all kinds of terrible things that our state does, like drone, you know, attacks in Pakistan, like Guantanamo, like, you know, surveillance. Right? I mean, there's all kinds of terrible things that our government does, and that's because that there are some other forces that are controlling the state. So I guess I believe that you want to have as little state as you need to get away with. You want to have the state be as not repressive as possible, and you want to have it be as democratically controlled as possible.
Well, isn't there a contradiction between democratic and state? Isn't it state mechanism, social mechanism, institution that represents the owning classes and operates pretty much in their interests. And you can have all kinds of complex social organizations with some imagination.
Mm-hmm.
If they were run directly in the interests of the people who actually work in the
So then you're saying that by definition. Yeah. And so I feel like what you're saying is that by definition, the state is that which is controlled by the ruling class, by definition.
No, it wouldn't be a state. That would.
Right, that's what you seem to say. What I'm saying is that you're saying that the state is that which is controlled by the ruling class.
That's right.
And so then, of course, I'm against the state.
Right.
But if a state is a mechanism whereby, let's say, like I work in the community college system, right? I think it's a really amazing thing. I think it's one of the most democratizing institutions in our country, though it's being destroyed by people in this city, Sacramento, that, you know, our representatives from all over the state, and it's terrible. But anyway, but, you know, I can imagine a system, you know, where the taxpayers all pay for a public education system, and it's administered by some administrators, because I don't want to have to do all that work, right?
That
and it's done in democratic ways, and...
Your community college is not democratic. You receive life support from the state, so that the tuitions have gone up, et cetera, et cetera,
right.
et cetera. You have no control over hiring and firing. So that's a perfect example of the state and the effect of the state being the institution of the ruling class in determining how things run. Same thing with the wonderful California public school and university system that now faces bourgeois families to attend.
Right, but when you say that it now takes bourgeois families to attend, which I think you're right, what you're saying is that something that had some good promise and was something better in the past is now something worse.
Well, what I'm saying is that there are institutions of the state which represents the needs of the ruling class. Mm-hmm. States, and consequently, no matter how many meetings you have among your professors and teachers, you do not control that institution. If you control that institution, no matter how complex it is, it would no longer be part of the state. But how you're going to do it if you have a system of financial system. The lifeblood, I don't know that stuff. It's very complicated. I'm just trying to point out a kind of obvious thing. The state doesn't mean a complex social system. It's kind of you can have the most complex social system that you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And so long as it's controlled by the working population.
Right.
Creates the wealth inside that institution and all that's connected to it do not represent the state.
Okay,
and
like
Marxist
I said,
definition.
That's right. And so what I'm saying is that Marxist definition of the state, by definition, the state is negative. Right. And so then it's just sort of like then it's just about the definitions. But so that's fine. So on your definition of a state, I'm against
the
state.
Marxist definition.
Yeah, no, on the Marxist, on the traditional Marxist definition of the state, I'm completely opposed to the state, period.
But
so I agree with you.
If we have a model that, like, even Ivan Illich talked about in Peace, School, and Society, where we had tools, where educational systems became tools of conviviality, where people could come together in a different situation, you know, but it's absolutely true. I mean, I just retired, went to school at the college and became a respiratory therapist. There's no work, so for the last 2.5 years since I graduated, I haven't been able to do anything in this highly specialized thing. But it's the numbers are determined by the state. You know, the state looks at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and it figures out how many graduates they need. Never mind the fact that a private company is going to come by and create another school, take funds and kind of go into complete competition and floods the market.
Right.
You know, so I mean, it's like what curve went wrong here, you know? And
but wouldn't you have to say too that if you look at this thing we call the state, I don't think we can just act as if, you know, we're just innocent and we don't have any part in the fact that I mean, if people are disenfranchised, their vote doesn't count. Because all these, like, community college, they have a community college board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's elected. One
Right.
Then to me, that's what I could say, well, you know, F the state, because it's not, like you said, it's not functioning in my benefit.
Right. And I guess all I'm trying to say is that there is, I want to claim, and you know, in disagreement with your perspective and with the standard Marxist perspective, that I want to say that the state is contested terrain and that we have some victories there. And that there's some extent to which, even in this extremely undemocratic society that we live in, that we, to some extent, have a voice. I mean, you know, I live in a very small town where, you know, elections, who gets elected to our city council really has nothing to do with money, right? It has to, and it has to do with who runs a good campaign. I was elected school board member, which is a very weird thing. I got totally red baited in the campaign, but I still won. But the point is that, you know, so if you take it down to that level, like, you know, imagine a small town like Pacifica where it's small enough that you don't need very much money to win. I would say in that situation, you can have a somewhat, and again, these things, all I want to say is that these things are contested. And like I said, in Pacifica, our side doesn't win because we're not very organized and we don't have good candidates who are, you know, willing to run. It's not because the bad guys are, you know, have so much money that they've captured the state. And I think that you could say, so that in my understanding of it, again, it's about social power. So in just like how the New Deal had all kinds of victories for the working class that I think are really important and important to claim these victories and not just say the state co-opted us, I think it's also true in a lot of Western Europe that the working class was stronger even than here and got some bigger victories. And yes, it's true that those are still capitalist countries and capitalist power still had enormous power. There's an incredible backlash happening right now where the American and British, you know, austerity model is now kind of taking hold in Europe. But I still think that there's a lot that's happened that were victories, and that the state is not just serving the interests of the capitalist class, it's also serving our interests. That's right, they're forced not to. Yeah, that's right. They're forced not to, and that force is really important. And that force is where the whole game is. Definitely.
It's like trying to start a fire without oxygen.
Yeah, and that's, yeah.
You can try, it's not going to happen. And that's, fast forward to now, the reason, you know, one of the major reasons it seems that the state has such a large role, it's so crucial to capitalism, because capitalism has become so much than it was when Marx and Engels and their predecessors were writing, that the state has become even more essential, you might say, more
right.
The oxygen to the fire of capitalism, which, as we know, has to grow and die. So essentially, it's really hard to speak about one without speaking about the other, and it seems to be any definitional conversation.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true. And in my the first chapter where I get into sort of like the nature of capitalism and all that, and it's just the basic critique. Right, that there's a thing in capitalist ideology that says that capitalism is just the freeing of markets, but it's just completely a lie. That capitalism has always required the state, right? And that, you know, one of the tragedies of you know, post-Soviet Russia was that the capitalists actually believed their own rhetoric, and they thought if they just sort of smashed that state, that then capitalism would just flourish, and it was just basically banditry. And it was, you know, lifespans in Russia went down tremendously in those years. It was really a horrible, horrible situation. So yeah, and then, oh yeah, actually, if you're going to have functioning capitalism, it turns out you need all these state structures. You need to have, again, sort of banking system and laws and roads and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, I really do agree with that traditional part, that part of the traditional Marxist analysis that says that states in capitalist societies are super important, and that a huge part of what they do is creating the conditions for capitalism. I mean, I completely agree with that. I'm just saying that that's not the whole story. That's all I'm saying. Yeah.
Well, our current situation is we should capitalism has failed, banks failed, you know, there's unemployment on and on. And yet we don't have any answer for that. Occupy seem to distrust both the leftists, the unions, the progressive remnants, and there weren't many of them because they had been assaulted before that. But you know, what are our tools to answer what should have been a great opportunity?
It's, you know, it's funny. I read Occupy really differently than that. I guess I read it as a huge victory that came and it went, right? In other words, it was never organized in a way that was going to be particularly sustainable, you know? And yet, I think it deeply transformed the society, you know? It made it so that it, so I think that Occupy was hugely successful. And I've given these talks a couple times and had somebody say, wait a second, why are you speaking the past tense? And I guess when I said, you know, and I was just in Santa Rosa just, you know, the other night, and you know, Occupy Santa Rosa or Sonoma County invited me, and they're really, like, Occupy in Santa, it's wonderful, in Sonoma County is still really vibrant. They meet like you guys meet, and it kind of is an ongoing organization and network. But in most places, it came and it went. I mean, in most places, it's gone, and certainly its biggest impact, I think, is probably in the past. And it was, but I think it was a huge impact because it changed the conversation and made it so that we're allowed to talk about class and inequality again. And I just think that that was completely, you know, unacceptable, you know, ever since McCarthyism. So I think it was hugely successful. And so I think that was one thing, and it was really great. And now there's a bunch of other stuff, and we'll see what happens from them. Yeah. Fair enough.
Yes. We're here, even though we may be invisible because of the corporate media.
has turned into something else, right? And it's turned into really different things in different communities, too. Yeah.
You mentioned a book called If Women Counted.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell me who wrote that?
Marilyn Waring, W-A-R-I-N-G. And there's a woman who got the Nobel Prize in Economics a couple years, in economics a couple years ago named Eleanor, and I always get her last name mixed up, but if you look at Nobel Prize and Eleanor, you'll find her, who did this really interesting work on the sort of the cooperative fabric that holds economies and people's worlds together. So it's all that stuff is starting to get some real recognition from the mainstream, which is very exciting. I mean, it's really exciting to me that, I mean, I think that one really big thing that's keeping, you know, pro-capitalist ideology anchored is mainstream economics. And in this country, pretty much 90%, more than 90%, I would say, of economics classes that are taught in this country are taught from the perspective that the economy means the capitalist economy, and that the better capitalism does, the better we're all off. And they never, you know, argue for those claims. That's just the paradigm. And it's really, really toxic. And so I actually think challenging the discipline of economics is really important. And it's just, and there have always been Marxist economists who have, you know, done really good, diligent work, but very much at the margins and very much marginalized. I mean, there's a few places. I went to school at UMass Amherst where there's a really thriving Marxist economics department. But there are also a lot of feminist economists, environmental economists, and this whole, like I said, this whole new economy paradigm. There's a real change that I see coming where, in fact, there's a movement in France that I thought was really great, started by students, called post-autistic economics. And the idea being that, you know, and no offense to autistic people, but one of the things about autism is the idea that you don't have good kind of, you know, social feedback loops. You know, you don't have a kind of good sense of what's going on socially. And that's actually the mainstream economics is basically like autism. And I think it's very, there are new ways of thinking about the economy. They're just beginning to emerge. And I think for anti-capitalists, it's really important to kind of watch that move. And I always say to my students, you know, when your economics teacher tells you that the minimum wage is bad for the economy, ask them how they know that. Because it's one of those interesting things that they'll say it's a fact because, of course, you know, when you disturb markets, it distorts everything and blah, 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 blah. But they never actually did empirical research on that. It turns out when people did studies on the effect of the minimum wage, surprise, surprise, prosperity goes up when the minimum wage goes up. You know, if Obama wanted a real stimulus, he would just raise the minimum wage. Game over. Everything, you know, we'd have a huge pause. But mainstream economists, it doesn't fit their paradigm. Yeah.
It's a correlation, but not a cause.
Yes, that's right.
That's a correlation, not a cause.
Yeah, except that the people who believe, you know, that it's something different have figured out the mechanisms. They, you know, when people say correlation, not causation, what they mean by that is that these things go together, but we don't know the mechanisms, right? And actually, the progressive economists have figured out the mechanisms, because guess what? If you give poor people more money, they spend it.
But
they actually spend it.
But we don't want them to, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. But all I'm saying is that that what's coming in economics is, I think, going to be really exciting, and it's really, really important. Yeah.
I love your discussion about happiness.
Uh-huh.
And what that might mean. I've thought, for instance, that, gee, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could sell my car? And what would that mean in my life? You know, there would be places that I might not be able to go and that sort of thing.
Right.
But would I be happier knowing that the air that I'm breathing is just a little bit cleaner?
Right.
And, you know, there was a report in the Sacramento Bee that we're at this 400 level now, which is very, very toxic.
The air pollution.
Uh-huh. But the carbon dioxide.
Oh, see, it's your greenhouse gases. Yeah. We're at 400 parts per billion, yeah.
And this is apparently is a very, very dangerous place to be. What would happen if we had a no-drive day when everyone in America would not drive their cars? And you know, maybe they wouldn't be able to get to work, so all of the workplaces would have to close down,
right.
And we would only get around the distance to where we could walk or ride our bicycles.
Right.
But everyone would be so happy because they would know in a profound way that we're doing something to make
right.
the air cleaner.
Yeah.
Or a happiness quotient about, you know, we're spending over half of our national money on war mechanisms, on killing people around, killing and controlling people around the world. What if we could take that money and use it to help people around the world? What would that do to our happiness?
It would make us very happy, because then you wouldn't have capitalism.
Yeah, and no, it's true. In other words, it's not going to happen unless you challenge the power structures.
It would certainly make all those people around the world much happier.
It sure would.
Yeah, and that's, you know, one of the things that I guess I'd like to say is that, you know, the what we need to do to solve these problems, in other words, what the utopia looks like is not actually that complicated. Even in terms of climate stuff, it's like the technology is already there. You know, we've figured it all out. It's just a matter of politics, right? I don't mean by that to belittle it, but it is a problem of politics as opposed to being a problem of kind of technical capacity or know-how or all those things. I read something recently that said that you could solve the problem of world poverty by just using the amount that Europeans spend on ice cream, right? It's like, it's really not. There are plenty of resources in the world. We produce enough stuff. Even when there's famines, there's always, every year, this world has always produced enough food to feed every human being on this earth. It's really a problem of power and control and that sort of thing, as opposed to a problem of prosperity. We have everything we need.
If there's such a strong community there,
They're, and that's one school here. All the other schools are here, and they're all in very low income neighborhoods where most of the people have brown skin as well. It's like it's just a horrible racism thing happening. Now, I know that there's been a lot of organizing with teachers, with parents, with various different parts of the cultural community, Hmong, Mexican in particular. So I know there's been a lot of organizing, but it's just that I was just around someone at this school recently, and just it sounded like, well, I got the message that, you know, it's got to close.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I have anything related to kind of a special words of wisdom. I mean, I teach community organizing, and it's, you know, people are often beaten down, you know, and feel very demoralized, and every once in a while people get together and they do a good job and fight those things. And some, you know, in Chicago they fought back, you know, a certain amount of that. I think there's still a struggle.
60 schools that were subject to closure in Chicago.
Right.
So there's a strong correlation between the school closures in recent times and the privatizations of schools through private charter
right.
operations. Almost one for one. They have a period of time.
Right.
And our superintendent here went to the same school financed by the Broad Foundation that were our charter school proponents. And there's obviously a connection
right.
between all these school closures and that school and the Gates Foundation and stuff like that. If a good way of challenging capitalism, because mm-hmm. this is one of the ways that capitalism apparently is found to invest their excess capital mm-hmm. and get tax stream money into mm-hmm. their veins. A good way of actually doing that is in the way that Chicago school teachers have. Problem is, at least in Sacramento, that the union is
not fired up.
Is worthless
yeah.
and actually challenging. The powers of the city
right.
in real ways.
Yeah, and I appreciate you saying that. I also do think that sort of exposing that, I mean, if that's the case in this particular situation, sort of exposing the privatization of education.
Oh, yeah, well,
you know, because that can't
our mayor is a leader in charter school.
Right.
And it's obvious what's taking place.
Right.
And the union here just seems to be aligned to Garfield.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
The superintendent of schools here at Sacramento County at the Sacramento County Office of Education is Dave Gordon. He's been there for a number of years, about 10 years now. But before he went there, he came from my community in Elk Grove, and he's very much in favor of privatizing schools through the charter.
Right.
And you mentioned the mayor of Sacramento. Michelle Reed may be brought up on federal indictments for manipulating test results
right.
in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
But I want to give an example of how communities fight things. We gave the first ever Praxis Award to a group of people in Avondale, Glen Elder, the neighborhood. And that association fought a five-year battle against the storage of 8 billion cubic feet of gas under their community. And they created a windstorm of effect that will have an effect on the storage of gas that comes from fracking. And so many people came together. It was amazing. And this is an example of how the capitalists undermine their own activities by giving seed money to the neighborhood association. They gave about $50,000 and said, do with it what you will. And what they did with it, to get this, was they created a thing called the Junior Giants
mm-hmm.
for all their kids to play baseball, soccer, football throughout the year. So they have year-round sports activities from this $50,000 seed money. And it was unbelievable. And so many movers and shakers in the being that this turned the tables on them, and the PUC, the first time, turned down, and then turned down the second time. So it looks like it's dead in the water, and they're not going to store gas there, and they've got all kinds of legal and precedent for preventing that kind of thing happening. But it was a huge struggle, and it took its toll on the community.
Right. And yeah, what you're saying, you know, it's also like Occupy, when you have a struggle like that and people come together, then they realize their capacity and they don't go back to being the same people anymore. Like the movements grow from those kinds of things. Yeah.
I just want to throw out my